Senate's Special Committee on Oil and Gas will come to order. We have present for the, and I'm happy that we're joined by House members today. Are we, is this a joint meeting?
Okay.
It's either Senate meeting and you're with us, or it's a joint meeting.
Either way is fine.
We have Senator Sharp and myself, the chairman, Senator Lehman, present, and the chairman of our House counterpart is Representative Joe Green. If you'd like to introduce your members, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There are with us today members of the House Oil and Gas Committee, Gary Davis and Joe Sitton. We hope to be joined by one or two more later in the morning.
Okay. And we have with us at the other end of the table Jim Eason, who is the Director of the Division of Oil and Gas. And Jim, welcome. Good morning. I'm glad you could join us. We're going to take up today Senate Bills 150 and 151, and I'm sorry, I don't have the numbers for the House counterparts are 199 and 200. What I'd like you to do, Mr. Eason, is to go through first with the House Bill 199, Senate Bill 150, give us an overview, and then we'll go to the other and recognize that we have just under an hour to complete this phase of it, and that we will have additional hearings in oil and gas. So just want to remind the members we don't have to ask all the questions today, but we do want to give Mr. Eason time to complete his work, and then I hope that we'll have time at the end to have questions and at least to start getting into some of the details. So go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the joint committees. For the record, my name is James Eason, and the chairman, I'm the director of the Division of Oil and Gas from the Department of Natural Resources. I appreciate this opportunity to meet with you this morning to talk about these two pieces of legislation, both of which we think are very important pieces of legislation to accomplish very focused goals. One of the things that I was asked, and I think it might be helpful if we spend just a couple of minutes, I was asked yesterday if I could just briefly recap how the competitive oil and gas leasing program works and how this piece of legislation is really designed as an adjunct to that, something that is not intended to replace it. As a matter of fact, we are convinced, based upon the historical record, that competitive leasing works just well, just fine, in those areas that have known oil and gas potential, but that there is the possibility that we think the legislation allowing exploration licensing to encourage exploration in areas that we have not been able to traditionally encourage with the competitive program. And probably the simplest way to do that is all of you had delivered to you yesterday copies of the five-year schedule, and I'm going to be speaking just for a moment from that schedule, realizing, of course, that the folks that are listening in from Anchorage and presumably other places may be a little lost by this process, but the first, on page 48 and 49 of that schedule, there is a small-scale map on page 48, along with a schedule, which all of you can't see from your end of the table, I apologize, that indicates two things. The map indicates the areas that are currently on our five-year schedule, which is required by statute that gets submitted to the legislature every 2 years. And generally speaking, the statutes require that any sale we're going to offer on competitive leasing terms has to be on the five-year schedule for at least 2 years, two calendar years, before the quarter in which it's scheduled to be held. There are exceptions to that rule. They're called exempt sales, and they're very narrowly focused. For example, we have the opportunity on a more expedited basis to offer lease sales involving acreage adjacent to that commercial discovery when there is a risk of drainage, so that there's an opportunity and an incentive for us to move quickly. And there are other exempt provisions that allow us to offer competitive sales on a more frequent basis than would otherwise be allowed if we had to go through the general provisions of the five-year schedule. The illustration on page 49 is an illustration of how the five-year schedule actually works. And if you look down probably to the best place, is starting in the 1996 sales, sale number 84, as a good example. If you notice going right across the columns through 1993, from 1993 to 1997, there are a series of events that have to happen for that sale. And if you look down below, you'll notice that they began with a addition of that sale to our five-year schedule, which we did. They followed at some point later, and you can see each one of these is a predictable timeline across the schedule with calls for comments, requests for general information on the sale area, request for socioeconomic and environmental information from state and federal and public agencies and the public sector, And then we began a preliminary land status check to make sure that the lands are state-owned lands and that they're available and unencumbered for leasing. We do preliminary findings of best interest and publish a notice of intent as well as a coastal zone consistency determination if the sale is in the coastal zone. We do public meetings if they're requested, as well as public hearings if the affected borough requests. And then we do a final notice based upon all the comments and feedback we've had on our preliminary notice. We do a final finding and notice of sale with the terms that are going to be included in that sale, including the lease form itself that's going to be used. And then finally, you'll see that the last step in that process is the sale itself. And that process takes, as you can see, a number of months. And it's primarily because there are a number of opportunities for the public to relate and interface with the department in its preparations for that sale. As I said before, we have found that historically competitive leasing has worked very well. We have a fairly long record of competitive leasing now. If you look in the back of your 5-year schedule, you will find a summary that outlines all the competitive sales that have been held, as well as the numbers of acres that were offered, the acres that were leased, and a summary of the revenues that were received as bonuses. And I think, again, as I've said in other forums this session, we saw in January of this year, I think, a good example of competitive leasing in Cook Inlet, in an area that had leasing for about 30 years, in which many people had written off the prospects of major oil discoveries occurring again, based upon apparently a very good discovery by ARCO and its partners. We were surprised, I think, as everyone was, to have an extraordinarily good sale, the third largest revenues ever received in an oil and gas leasing sale since the state began leasing. So we think in areas like Cook Inlet and in the majority of the North Slope, competitive leasing has and will continue to work very well. We, however, had looked at areas in the interior. There are a number of areas. Well, pardon me just one moment, I'm going to step away from the microphone, but I'll speak up. We put this geologic map up today. It's, again, it's larger, but probably no more easier to read from where you're sitting. But you members may want to take a look at it in a few moments. You'll see that there are a number of areas, for example, here, that identified in Yukon Flats Basin. Over here, the Seward Peninsula, the Noatak Basin, the Kotzebue Basin, the Minchumina Basin here. There are a number of areas throughout the interior of Alaska, as well as on the periphery, near the coastlines in areas other than the North Slope and Cook Inlet, which are thought to have oil and gas potential. But so little is known about them that really about all that can be said in some cases is that these areas appear to contain sedimentary rocks, in other words, the rocks that are most likely to contain accumulations of oil and gas. It's unknown whether or not the history, the history of thermal history and the depositional history and the other things that petroleum explorationists want to look for, it's unclear how those events have unfolded in those basins, and of course, as a result, it's unclear really what their oil and gas potential is. It's just known that it is possible that there may be oil and gas there. And over the years, we have tried to encourage exploration of those basins through the competitive program by periodically making those areas available, putting them on the schedule. But finding as we move toward the final preparation, that in a lot of cases there is no interest in participating under the competitive leasing terms, and in some cases so little interest that in fact people just didn't show up. So last year, among other things, we began to look at to see if there was some alternative to the competitive program, particularly targeted to those areas that would encourage people under different terms to take the risks of exploring in very high cost and also very geologically risky and very likely economically risky terrain. And the bill that we're here, the first bill that we're here to discuss today, SB 150, is the bill that resulted from that effort to try to determine if there was an alternative. And I'd like to take just a few minutes so that everyone has an opportunity to ask as many questions as you like, to summarize the general provisions of that bill. I find it helpful to think of it in terms of what it was intended to accomplish, what rights did it invest in a potential licensee, what the general terms of a license would be, what the procedures for obtaining a license would be, and then based upon the best interest finding, if it's determined that a particular license is in the state's best interest, finally I'd like to discuss for just a moment what the department's actions are at that time and what the licensee's actions are, and finally, presuming that a license is issued, and that the work commitment required under it is successfully completed, it invests certain additional rights in the licensee, and those rights include the right to convert all or a portion of that license area to a lease. With that framework, the first thing that should be said is obviously it will be necessary, if this legislation passes, to adopt regulations defining how we will implement the statutes. We have actually begun the drafting of those regulations with the hope that the legislature sees fit to pass this legislation. We understand that the regulations are likely to be a fairly lengthy and drawn out and relatively complex process, so we have begun within the division to try to get off our policy paper, but of course that will be a very public process as we get a framework or schedule of what we would hope to use for regulations. After the adoption of regulations and presumably the passage of legislation to the adopt report, we would require, before any license, a preliminary written determination of the lands that the commissioner of the department feels are eligible or should be eligible for licensing. And that written determination would be available for at least 30 days as a public notice. In other words, it would be published in a newspaper or statewide circulation in one or more other forums for public participation. Based upon the feedback that we would get from that effort, the next step would be a written determination of the applicability. In other words, a written determination of the areas that we are intending to make available for licensing. And it's our thought that this process could be done more than one time. And the reason for that, as we'll discuss a little bit later, is that the legislation also provides, in addition to those areas of unidentified oil and gas potential, the ability to offer areas that have been offered for competitive lease but unleased in the future. So it's entirely possible that areas that we originally would not intend to be eligible for licensing may in fact at some point in the future be eligible, in our view, for licensing, simply because they have been made available for competitive leasing perhaps one or more times, but have been unable to draw the attention that we hoped they would. What rights attach to a licensee under the legislation? The rights are the exclusive right to explore the area covered by the license for a period up to 10 years. It's not a right to explore for 10 years, it's a right to explore for up to 10 years. The potential license term would be subject to review by the department and a determination of what is proper, just exactly how long should be given to accomplish the proposed work program that the licensee has proposed. In some cases, arguably, it will be appropriate to have a shorter term for that license period, particularly if it's an area, or if the area of the license is not a particularly large one. And of course, an additional right attaches, and that's the option to convert part or all of that area to lease under predefined terms that will be defined before the license is issued, and the factors that would be required to enable one to make that conversion would be stated in advance. The general terms of any license that we propose to issue. First, the license area would be exempt from certain statutory acreage limitations that are currently applied to competitive lease. For example, there is a limitation on the total tide and upland acreage, tideland and upland acreage, that a lessee can hold, and those are 500,000 acres each. And there's also a limitation on the size of any lease that's offered competitively. That limits you to acreage of 5,760 for any one lease. We would propose that both of those provisions would not apply to a license area. In fact, the license area we're proposing would be a maximum of 500,000 acres. Again, there could be license areas considerably smaller. They would depend upon the area that is either recommended by the commissioner for licensing or an area that's proposed but yet eligible by LSE initiating and proposing. License is conditioned upon a work commitment of a specified amount. And one of the questions that we had earlier about this legislation is whether or not we are foregoing or trading bonus revenues for work commitments. And that probably it's an oversimplification of what we're trying to accomplish, but it really is, I think, a very good way of looking at it. Traditionally, for areas where you discover oil and gas, the real revenues for the state are the landowners, quite a number, are not from the bonus that's received up front. Those can be quite large, and often they're the only money that you receive. Mukluk, for example, for those of you with long memories, is a good case for that. But generally, your large revenues are going to come from the royalties and the severance taxes and the other related income that arises from a successful development in oil and gas. In this case, we're proposing that the money that would traditionally have gone to bonuses actually get into the ground earlier. And what we're proposing is that the bid variable for a license be the dollar amount of work that is committed to be done on the lease under the time frame and in the procedures and process outlined in the license itself. Things that would qualify would be the conducting of geophysical surveys and drilling of exploration wells. And those would be the types of things that we would want to hear from the licensee or potential licensees regarding the amount that you're willing to give, if you will. There's also a provision in the license that the commission would have the authority to revoke if there's non-compliance with the agreed upon work plan. The license also carries a performance bond. Under our proposal, the bonding amount would be no less than the value of the work program to which a lessee is committed. And we realize, in proposing this legislation, that is likely to be one of the more controversial aspects of it, because we listen to both sides of the spectrum and everything in between. There are many people who argue that there should be no bonding. There are other people who argue that there should be absolute bonding. And there are people, as I said, that argue in between. When we look at the system we're proposing, it appears to us that if there's no bonding, then there's really no performance. It's easy to bid the moon and perform nothing. We've seen it before, and we'll see it again. It's just human nature. Also, if you require bonding in the amount of a responsible, hopefully large exploration program, by definition, you're going to exclude some parties. Some parties who simply cannot generate the funds to participate. But on balance, we've also seen a situation where, in retrospect, we've regretted setting the hurdle too low because we've encouraged development in some cases on leases, oil and gas leases, and in some cases on developments associated, surface leases associated with oil and gas development, for folks who simply did not have the capital to meet the long-term commitments of environmental compliance and other requirements. And the state has inherited the ability or the responsibility, if you will, to pay for that. So it's a balancing between those two extremes, which I'm sure you will come to grips with as you consider this legislation. As we did, we're trying to build a responsible system, one that the state gets something in return for its commitment to allow this exclusive use in an area and exploration, as well as the right to convert to a longer-term lease. We think it's a very serious right, carrying lots of obligations, and as well as lots of responsibility and lots of opportunity. And we think that the state's return should be commensurate with that. The license would also require a non-refundable $1 per acre license fee. And that would require, an explicit agreement by the licensee that the cost of the work commitment as they are performed on the subject audit. As for the licensing procedure, as the statute is drafted, we have set up a system where either the commissioner, once he has established by written decision the areas where licenses might be appropriate, or a potential licensee, either one, could propose a specific license area. We've also, though, tried to provide some protection so that we don't have to come back to the legislature every year and say we're running out of money. We have owned, as a sideboard, for those areas that are proposed by potential licensees, we've set a limit once a year to accept those applications. And that's just for administrative convenience and to make the project really workable, because as you will see, when you look at the statutes and think about the regulations that are going to be required, you could create an agency essentially that deals with nothing but talking with folks and trying to see if you can carry a process through to completion for different proposed licenses, unless you set one time a year that you're going to entertain license proposals regardless of where they are. It's just, it's convenient for both parties, but one that we think would be completely unworkable unless we do provide some limits there. We simply don't have the staff to do it. If the procedure is initiated by the commissioner, it would require public notice with a solicitation for comments and competitive proposals. We essentially would consider anything that came in at that time, as long as it complied with the areas that are written and confirmed as being available for licensing purposes. If it's initiated by a potential licensee, there is, in this particular bill, a requirement that the commissioner must either accept it or reject within 30 days and provide that decision in a written decision. And that doesn't mean he accepts all the terms. That means he accepts and finds that it's probably, not probably, finds that it's in the state's interest to proceed to determine whether a license can be crafted that would protect the state's interest and would accomplish its intent and hopefully get this exploration underway. If it's accepted, the commissioner then solicits comments and, well, as I said, a competing proposal. And there is a provision that the commissioner may also request additional information in writing if it's determined that the proposal is either unclear, not specific enough, or for whatever reason there is a need for additional information. There's then a period for the commissioner to consider proposals and the public comment on those proposals. Following that, the commissioner would issue a written finding addressing all the matters which are addressed in a best interest finding for a competitive sale. For example, all those matters contained in AS 3805-035-D and G, except for the limited provision in 3805-035-G1K, and we can look that up for you later if you like. If that best interest finding determines that a license should be issued, there are certain actions, as I said, the department must undertake at that time. And those include compiling the limitations, stipulations, and conditions or changes that the department feels are required to make the proposal or proposals that have been submitted in the state's interest. This is presuming that the proposal as originally submitted does not accomplish that. If there was only one proposal, at that time the identity of the prospective licensee is published, a copy of the license that would be used, and the convertible lease, the lease that would be awarded following successful completion of the work program, is attached to the best interest finding, and then copies of that entire package are made available to all prospective licensees whose proposals were considered. And then there are certain actions that the licensees or licensee are responsible for. If there's only one license, only one licensee, the licensee must accept or reject the conditional license, in other words, the license as conditioned by the stipulations and terms that the commissioner has attached, within 30 days. If there's more than one licensee proposing a program, there will be an outcry auction under regulations which will be adopted to determine the licensee that's willing to bid the highest work commitment to perform the actions that are proposed in the license area. And as I said earlier, the amount of the minimum work commitment, again, is a bit variable, but in this case, you're giving the opportunity for competing proposals to have one last shot at what I would call a competitive forum, but bidding into the work commitment as the bid variable. Following that, there's the opportunity of the legislation to convert, as I said, all or part of the area to a lease. When conversion to the lease occurs, there are several things that have to precede it, and there are several conditions that would attach to the lease. The first thing, of course, and the most important, is that all the work commitment that has been proposed in the license has to have been completed in full. If it isn't, there's no conversion to lease. The license is in default, for instance. Any lease that results from a license conversion is limited to a maximum size of 30,000 acres. Any lease that is issued would also be conditioned to a minimum 12.5% royalty, just as we do with the competitive lease approach. And it would be conditioned upon the payment of a $3 per acre rental fee. That's an annual rental fee. And of course, the lease, would be subject to the other terms and conditions in the lease, which were determined at the time the license was issued, as well as being subject to all valid state and federal laws and regulations that are adopted after the license period. So we think that, as I said before, this is a vehicle that will offer an opportunity for the vesting of rights, which are considerable in scale, the opportunity to explore very large areas in the maximum sense up to 500,000 acres for a predefined period of time without competition to explore and develop that area. and of course the opportunity to convert to lease anything that, that you choose based upon your completion of the work. That, in summary, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, is the way the legislation is intended to operate. And I would be happy at this time to try to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Eason. I think we can take about 5 minutes worth of questions from the committee. All others are thinking of their questions. I just want to go down here to section 2 of the bill and note the possibility the commission may offer additional incentives, including reducing the royalty to a minimum of 5%. When do you anticipate that that would occur? What are the conditions? And why is that in there? And I just want to note that we've been joined by Senator Halford and Representative Brown. You're in the audience. If you'd like to join us at the table, you're certainly welcome to do so.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As to the origin of that provision, I'm not very clear on that. It's a provision that's been in the statute since my familiarity with the statute began. I presume that it was intended to, I just simply don't know. As to whether or not it's our intent that those two things would be linked, it is not that it is not our intent that a license, for example, that might be issued under this legislation would be entitled to consideration for a royalty deduction at the time of licensing. It is our intent, though, that any royalty, let's do it this way, step back. There are provisions in the statutes and our regulations for reducing royalties based upon certain preconditions, and that is determinations of essentially non-commerciality that may in fact occur with fields as they approach their latter stages. And in those cases, any lease, any lessee, any unit comprised of a number of leases which can make the showing required by regulations that would justify their reduction of royalty. We would not propose that leases that originated as licenses originally be denied the royalty reduction that might be available to them based upon legitimate reasons should they otherwise qualify. But we also are providing that a license converted to a lease has a minimum of 12.5% royalty. So by definition, we do not intend to offer a 5% royalty as a license condition.
I guess when you were explaining, I realized that this is the part where there's really no change by this proposal. And at the time of the offering, you expected, or at the time of the conversion to the lease, you expect it will be 12.5%. But you don't want to exclude that possibility that it could, in the future, be converted. And my friend Representative Green says he can explain it even more.
Yeah. I was just going to add a little historical note on the 5%. That was in the past was a discovery royalty, and it applied to a new discovery of a horizon of a structure, not necessarily all the horizons within the structure, but the first bit into what ultimately became a productive reservoir. That structure then was a new discovery, and that first horizon was subject to a 5% royalty, and they called it a discovery royalty. Subsequent horizons that were productive within that same structure didn't enjoy that.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. That is the only application I'm familiar of that provision. But as Representative Green first is aware, the discovery royalty provision was repealed from statute several years ago, and yet this piece remains in statute. So in theory, there is the opportunity for the commissioner to adopt regulations and to use reduced royalties as an incentive in a different sense than the discovery royalty was initially used. That's, to my knowledge, that is the only application that has ever been applied, but it's still there, as you know, in the statute. But as I said a moment ago, you're correct also, Senator Lane, in that when we issue a license with a lease that would have a 12.5% minimum royalty, could have a higher royalty, but no less than 12.5%, it would be our intent that if it converts the lease, it would convert at 12.5%, and the only way it would ever be reduced beyond the lower 12.5% would be to make the showings that it's necessary to do that in order to encourage continued production as required under the statutes and regulations.
Also note that we have on teleconference Ken Boyd, who's the Deputy Director of the Division of Oil and Gas, and Mr. Boyd, if you feel that you need to break in and add anything or add any comments, please feel free to do so. Senator Sharp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just question on page 5, under the section conversion to lease, number 4. Is it the standard procedure in current law that once a royalty exceeds the amount of the annual rent of the lease, that the rent goes away?
That's correct.
Any other questions for Ms. Beeson? Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a myriad of questions I'm not going to burden this group with now. We will be hearing, as Senator Lehman said, we will be hearing this again. I have just one thought, really more than a question, that the has to do with the bonding, that a total commitment to a large basin could be pretty significant and therefore require, for the state's protection, a fairly large bond. Is there any thought at all that there possibly could be an overall commitment that shows in a segment of years and that the bonding could be reduced to an annual performance? In other words, if you had 5 zonks that you were going to do for a 10-year lease or whatever, and zonk 1 was going to be in this particular year, could you bond just that much and not preclude some possible bidders because they couldn't afford the bond for the total package?
Representative Green, members of the committees, we haven't really focused a great deal on options that might be allowable. We certainly are aware there are a number of ways you could structure that. The thing that I think has to be balanced, if you consider those types of options as opposed to what we proposed, is how the risk sharing, if you will, in the arrangement is taking place. Because arguably, if you want to take a bite at a time from the bonding side, I think it's arguable that you should only take a bite at a time in what you're earning side also, so that you keep the scales balanced. And one of the things that we have heard and are very sensitive to, because we actually believe that in fact it's the truth, is that one of the central pieces or attractions of licensing in any part of the world where this is done, as you well know, in many different oil and gas jurisdictions, and one of the principal, if not the principal attraction, is the ability to have certain a fairly large area that you're going to be able to convert to lease based upon your performance and hopefully your success in finding something. And as we've structured it now, we think it strikes that balance between allowing that option, giving those rights, as well as keeping a bundle of obligations in a significantly proportioned way. And if we were to consider looking at segmenting or incrementing the commitment, I think it would be probably appropriate to look at incrementing the earning of rights so that they don't all happen at the license stage, but they have to be built with performance.
Mr. Eason, you indicated that when there are competitive proposals, the commissioner will evaluate and the variable will be dollars. Does that mean I guess I'd call the qualitative part of a proposal, people may have different plans, but the DNR is not going to second guess what the potential licensee plans to do in evaluating the proposal to see if that is indeed in the best interest of the state, but instead we'll look only at the dollars?
It's possible, Senator Lehman, and what we would propose to do, as a matter of fact, is if there are different proposals for the same area, is in fact to try to determine whether a mixture of terms would be in the state's best interest. If one proposal, for example, proposed 20 million worth of geophysical work, another proposed $4 million worth of geophysical work and 2 wells. There obviously is an opportunity there to force people to come together and rethink their individual proposals and perhaps do a better one jointly. Or in fact, it may be possible for us to decide that a proposal, given the area involved, would a proposal that would be more in the state's interest would require some combination of the things that are being proposed. But we wouldn't propose to institute that without putting it out for response to the licensees to see if there's interest in doing the program that we think is proper.
Further questions from the committee? Okay, if you'd like to move on to Senate Bill 151 and House Bill 200, which is somewhat related but different, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The The Exploration Incentive Credit Bill is a companion to this piece of legislation. It's obviously not directly related by intent. It is a separate piece of legislation, but it's intended to accomplish many of the same goals of the large block licensing proposal. That is, it's to encourage the earlier exploration and evaluation of lands throughout the state, not only state-owned lands, but lands that adjoin state-owned lands, so that the state can be in a better position of understanding the oil and gas potential of its lands and have better information on which to manage those lands, and hopefully to get those into a leasing or a licensing program if this legislation passes, if the prior legislation passes. As you know, probably from having read the one-page paper that was distributed, the position paper on this bill, this legislation would really represent the expansion of some existing legislation in Title 38. We currently have the ability and have been using the statutory authority to offer exploration incentive credits for competitive leases throughout a number of areas across the state over the years. And as a matter of fact, again, in your five-year oil and gas leasing schedule, there is a summary of all the areas where we have offered exploration incentive credits, what the terms of those credits were, and what the total cumulative amount of the state's payments and as a result of those credits are to date. There's also a provision in Title 38 today that allows us to offer exploration incentive credits for geophysical work, but it's a very limited provision. And in fact, under current statute, those credits can only be offered if exploration is undertaken, geophysical exploration is undertaken, on lands that are being offered within 2 years on the state's five-year oil and gas leasing schedule, and those data are made confidential, are made public following the holding of that sale. The current legislation, the proposed legislation, expands, as I said, the authority and the applicability for issuing exploration incentive credits. In addition to state-owned lands, the credits would be available for operations conducted on private land throughout the state, on lands essentially that would provide the state information to help manage its lands. There are limitations in the legislation. Under Title 38, there are no limitations on the maximum amount of credits that could be offered by the state over the years. Under this proposed bill, there is a $50 million cap, and the period during which activities that might be available or might be eligible for those credits may be undertaken is 10 years. And there's also a cap on individual projects. It's intended that no project, the state's share of no project would exceed $5 million. There's also a ratio of the state's participation in a project for private lands would be limited to 25% of the cost. And for state lands or for other lands would be 50%. There's also a provision that as with other exploration incentive credit legislation, there would be a provision for auditing and to determine that the cost, the direct costs which are eligible for EICs are properly charged, and the state essentially is not paying for more than it's bargained for. That's the summary of the basic terms of this legislation. Again, it is intended primarily for application where the Title 38 exploration incentive credit is not eligible. One major difference I should point out before I finish here, one major difference on the exploration for geophysical exploration is that there is no requirement that the exploration be conducted on land that's scheduled for sale. That gives us the flexibility to review any project that is proposed in advance, whether it be the drilling of a well or the conducting of geophysical exploration, to make the determination of whether that information really appears to have some value for the interpretation of state-owned lands. If it's not in the state's interest, there's no obligation under this bill that we support or participate. And that's intentional. It's not intended that we pay for something that doesn't benefit the state. It's really designed as a tool to benefit both parties, to encourage more information earlier on behalf of everybody, with the theory being that development anywhere in state land or private land within the state is going to be to the benefit ultimately of all the citizens.
Do we have questions, Mr. Easton? Senator Sharp.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Easton, on the third page, As I recall, we had similar legislation, and I think it died in House Finance last year because of incentive. I thought it was all 50% of eligible cost in the previous bill, and not 50 and 25. Is this 25% a reduction from what was offered previous years?
That's correct, the bill that was under consideration last year treated all lands equally, and this bill would treat the private lands with a more allowable credit, and that's a conscious decision predicated upon the likelihood that all of those lands, or the evaluation of those lands, is going to have some value to the state. It is likely that it's going to be reduced value just simply because of the remoteness of many of those lands, and it was a conscious decision to do that.
Thank you.
Senator Helford?
The $50 million limit is a combined limit for the entire term of this legislation, which goes to, 2003?
Senator Helford, it's correct that the $50 million limit would apply to geophysical surveys or wells drilled under this proposal that have to be conducted within the 10-year period. But as you'll note when you read the legislation, it's intended that projects covered or that are conducted in that period would be eligible if they're pre-approved for eligibility, but that the period in which they could recoup then any credits they earn is extended, I think, for another 5 years, as I recall. So it's an exposure, if you will, to recoupment that goes out to longer than the 10-year period, but you know at the end of the 10-year period what activities, in fact, have earned what credits, and you have a cap on what would be expected.
But the maximum total credited activity, or no, the maximum total amount of the credit over 10 years is $50 million.
That's correct.
So it's $5 million a year.
It doesn't have to be $5 million a year.
Or
as it's established,
$5 million a year for 10 years.
That's correct. But in theory, anyone could come in. There may be three or four proposals, just hypothetically, in year three, that all are very legitimate proposals, things that should be done, and the state might elect to do them, and then there may not be any other proposals for the remainder of the period.
Is that a significant enough amount to have any impact at all?
We believe it is, Senator. The cost of drilling in an interior basin is a significant expense. Just mobilizing and placing equipment into a lot of the areas that we're hoping to encourage this kind of evaluation are very costly. But for geophysical operations, the opportunity also exists for the contractor, and we're presuming that this would be a more attraction to contractors such as Western Geophysical and other companies. Also has the ability to market the information that they gather. And so it's a cost-sharing arrangement that is not intended to pay for their entire program, but it's to encourage them to cross that hurdle in those situations where they are at or very near the point of making a decision, but for the participation of the state.
I don't disagree with it being cost-sharing and not cost-shifting, but I think the limitation is unrealistic if you expect it to be any real incentive for major exploration budgets.
What would be the impact if that limitation were lifted or were increased substantially? What do you see as the impact?
Senator Layman, members of the committees, it would increase your exposure in an undefined way. But as I said earlier, you have similar exposure today under Title 38. You've given the commissioner authority to use exploration incentive credits. It's always done with a best interest finding for a specific sale. But essentially, when a decision is made to use those credits apply to every lease that's issued, as long as it meets certain requirements. But generally speaking, every lease is eligible for credit. And obviously, that's tremendous exposure if every lessee went out and drilled a well the first year or the second.
What a wonderful thing.
it's a lot of financial exposure, but it doesn't work that way. People generally won't drill silly wells. And assuming they're informed, they will drill wells that are responsible and reasonable prospects. And what this does is it really helps the economics in those situations where companies have determined there's such a high risk that they were perhaps unwilling to commit on their own, but the EIC over the years, I think, has been very effective in providing the last piece in a puzzle that sometimes has been missing.
Thank you, Cecil. Further questions? Senator Helfer?
You've used a and I don't know, it just seems that in economic theory, credits work better if they're shorter term and you can't count on them that far away. If you're trying to encourage optional performance, it would seem that you'd be better off to take the $50 million allowance and put it in the first 2 years and say if you don't do it in the first 2 years, you don't get it. I wonder what the internal debate on those numbers was. Or am I totally wrong and that economic theory is no longer valid?
No, Senator, I believe you're entirely correct. There are some very strong arguments to be made for the approach you suggest, particularly if you are very concerned about throughput from the Trans-Alaska Pipeline and from Cook Inlet production and other production declining to a point where operations may be non-economic on a fairly short-term basis, or midterm, 2000, 2005, somewhere in that range. Obviously, given the timelines to bring discoveries into production, that argues for the quickest, most powerful that you could have for incentives. What we have done here is propose that the 10-year period be available, but we certainly aren't, as I said before, trying to restrict applications or projects to being strung out during that period. Under the proposal, if there were a number of projects that came in next year, if this legislation was passed, that were all, that all made sense, the flexibility would be there not to give individual projects more than $5 million, but to commit the state's participation to a fairly large sum very quickly.
Senator Helfer?
Well, but the other side of that is if you know the credit's going to continue, you don't have the incentive to go ahead and accelerate your program and do it as quickly as you could, unless you think that the maximum amount of the credit, i.e. the $50 million, will be used up before you get to it. But it just seems that there needs to be some incentive for acceleration. I mean, you know, when the federal government finally threw away all the investment tax credits, most of us that could figure out something to go buy, we went and bought it before that deadline. And it seems that a deadline helps you in terms of accelerating the near term of that thing, not just the race to spend a small amount of money effectively, if you're talking about spreading it over the entire industry over 10 years.
Senator Helfer, I think you're entirely correct that in your view that one of the motivators will be the concern that in fact there may be $50 million of projects that come in the first year, and if you wait, you lose. The other thing that has probably less impact, but is a very real one, is of course the company's view of the time value of money. $50 million tomorrow is worth a lot more than $50 million in 2002. And finally, I think the most important thing is that I believe the sort of semi-euphoria, I never get totally euphoric, but I've been semi-euphoric for several months now about the developments on the North Slope and the number of wells they're drilling this winter and the developments in Cook Inlet. And I'm seeing that euphoria translated to lots of different companies outside of the state that haven't been participants here, including foreign companies. And I think that in itself would provide the biggest incentive. If there's anyone out there interested in looking at these interior basins, I think the time is now. And they're going to be driven that direction to begin with. And I really believe it's sort of a self-correcting piece of legislation in that respect, that people are going to be inclined for a lot of different reasons to try to pick projects that may be eligible early on.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is the work commitment that you anticipate time related, or is it just within the 10-year period? In other words, is it like a current lease where you have to do something within 10 years or you lose the lease, or is it more like, say, a unit where there are certain time periods in which you have to accomplish A, B, and C of the work commitment?
Representative Green, as we would see the system working, to use a hypothetical, let's assume that the project or the legislation passes and we're in the third year. We're in 1996, and we've expended, we've applied our allowed credits, which we know we're going to have to match of $35 million. And we've got $15 million left. And two companies came in with proposals. Let's make it really simple. Let's just say one company comes in that year with a proposal to conduct so many miles of geophysical survey. Let's say it's going to cost them $14 million, and we think it's a survey that is really worth having. It's in an area where we have absolutely no information, but there are other indicators, no subsurface information, but very good indicators from surface sampling and other geologic mapping that there's potential there. It's an area we really have an interest in, and we think that it'll encourage other people to look, and there'll be a market for that survey. If we decide to commit a credit, we tell them that we will participate in that project up to $5 million. It fits the criteria of the regs. Then they, of course, have proposed a time that they intend to conduct that survey. Let's say their proposal is they're going to do it in the winter of 1997. It would not be our view to hold them to that commitment. We are interested in the conducting of that survey, not so much that it gets done in that winter. If it, in fact, takes another winter for whatever reason, let's say they run into permitting problems and delays, they've got our commitment that we will credit or that we will participate. We would probably put some limit on the timing for that, but if they haven't performed by a certain time, we are not obligated to pay simply so that we can keep the money available for other projects that may be worthwhile that would otherwise be creditable had this obligation not been outstanding. But there would be no time limits as such other than that. The intent is to try to encourage things as quickly as possible, but responsibly and, you know, in an environmentally sound manner.
Thank you, Mr. Eason, and thank you for each of you who participated today. We have one more question. We'll take one final question. Then we're getting the sign that we need to vacate for the next committee.
Same line wants to come in.
Senator Halford.
With regard to the assignment of these credits, they can be assigned by the qualified applicant to any other person. Does this mean that essentially the entity that gets the credit may not owe any taxes but can assign the credit to another taxpayer, or i.e. sell the credit?
That's correct, Senator. That's the intent. And it's in recognition that, for example, the geophysical companies, none of those that I'm aware of operating in Alaska right now, for example, have royalty or severance tax obligations. They may have corporate tax obligations, but they may be inadequate to cover the amount of the credit. So it gives them an opportunity to use a credit by selling it or trading it to others who can use it.
Okay. Again, tell me how long they can hold their piece of the credit by applying for it before they actually do the work.
There is no set limit in the statute, and we would address that in regulations. And just in general terms, I can tell you how we would try to balance it. We don't have a time in mind, but we would try to establish a balance that allows for sufficient time, anticipating that there may be process or regulatory problems that a permittee or applicant encountered. We want to be sure that that doesn't penalize them, but we also want to be sure that someone doesn't sew up, if you will, a credit and then go out and spend the next 5 years trying to find other underwriting of that, so that the state finds itself in a position of not being able to participate in projects that are going, because it is committed to participate in projects that aren't going to go. And that's going to be a difficult part.
And that's a real danger.
That's a very real danger.
Because essentially the credits then are doing nothing.
That's correct. So we will be very attentive to being sure that we provide sideboards there that are, you know, we're going to have them very reasonable, but we have to have some sideboard, otherwise we run into that problem.
You have no interest in having any of those so-called sideboards in the statute?
Senator, that's discretionary, obviously, with the legislature, and we would certainly respect your comments.
Other comments, questions? Just want to note that we will be taking up in the Senate Special Committee on Oil and Gas these two bills again next Tuesday, March 23rd, 5 o'clock. And for those on the committee, I suggest if you have amendments that you bring those, we may be moving the bills. There'll be for possible movement of the bills from oil and gas at that time. Next meeting is on Thursday, March 18th, 5 o'clock, Senate Bill 134, Credits for Purchasers of State Royalty Oil. There being no further business come before our committee, we will stand adjourned. Yeah.